Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Good morning and welcome to Out the Box on Chai FM 101.9, the show for minds that don't fit the mold, but hearts that keep striving. As many of you know, this topic we're going to be talking about today is really one that is close to my heart. I'm a mother of three boys, and I have my own lived experience when it comes to barriers to learning, real support, and what inclusion is. I've sat in the meetings, asked the difficult questions, and I have felt tremendous frustration. But I've also learned that these conversations are very rarely black and white. And there are real challenges for families, real challenges for schools, and the best outcomes usually come when we understand both perspectives. So today we're asking a question that affects thousands of South African families. What does real inclusion mean, and does it work? My guest today is Dr. Karen Levine, a speech and hearing pathologist and doctor of psychology with more than 40 years experience working with children, families, and schools. Karen holds a master's in speech and hearing therapy from WITS and a PhD in psychology from Stellenbosch University. Her PhD research was done as a critical disability study on how adults with cerebral palsy and communication impairments participate in society, which gives her a very rare understanding of what inclusion means. Karen worked in state hospitals, then she worked at Forest Town School for 10 years. She spent 18 years lecturing at WITS and was promoted as the HOD. And for the last 15 years, she's been in private practice. She's also a wife to a fabulous husband, a mother of two sons, a keen gardener, a self-confessed foodie, and I am so proud to say, my cousin. Karen, welcome to Out the Box.
Thank you, Simi. And it's lovely to be here, and thank you for inviting me.
We're going to look at what the education system promises and what they can actually deliver. So when we hear the phrase inclusive education, and we hear that all the time, it seems to be a bit of a buzzword. If you had to explain it simply to a parent, how would you describe it?
Okay. So inclusion means that every child should be included in every school. All children should be provided with education in all schools. In other words, there are no special schools, no remedial schools, no schools for kids with CP. It is a concept that there should be no discrimination. So therefore, all children, no matter what their disability, no matter what their level of ability, should go to school with everybody else. That's what inclusion is.
And I mean, we're going to get to it as we go along, but it just doesn't seem feasible at all. You know, most people, or actually I don't think most people, because I wasn't aware of it until a while ago, the White Paper 6. Can you explain what it is and why it mattered so much? And perhaps what happens now?
Okay, so when South Africa became a democracy, the new government had to change policy on everything from health to social services to education. Mm. As we know, in the past in South Africa, we have a vile history of providing education for black children, education for white children. And children with disabilities were seriously disadvantaged because not only were there no schools for them where the white kids had schools, they were also just left at home. So the white paper came along, and in this white paper, it aligned with the international concept of inclusion. And it said all children, no matter your color, no matter your language group, no matter your level of disability, will be educated. in the country, and everybody will be educated together. There will be no discrimination. That's what the white paper is all about. And it, I don't want to go into too much detail about it, but it was quite specific in how things should be structured, and it also provided a timeline. There was a timeline as to when everything that was in the white paper was going to be implemented. Now, remember, this is policy. It's not law.
Right.
Okay. This is very a very, very important thing for people to understand, that the white paper is a policy document, and it's a government policy document, in other words, ANC document.
Right.
Okay. That, that suggests to us how things should be done, but it's not actually law. But we do have legislation as well.
Why did the white paper not become law?
Because it has to go through Parliament, and it was a working document. And, yeah.
Okay.
It's policy.
Right.
And policy should not have to become legislation, but aspects of policies become legislation over time.
Right.
It's very difficult to change legislation, where it's easier to modify policy as time goes on.
So what does that mean for a school if it's policy only?
Okay, so we don't, the white paper is not the only document that we have to be cognizant of. There are other policy documents as well. For example, we signed into, it's called the Salamanca Statement.
Mm.
The Salamanca Statement was a UNESCO, United Nations document that said all kids should learn together. And we agreed to that. We also signed into, it's called the CALI document, C-A-L-I. It was something done in Colombia. It was an international forum in about 2019. And we've ratified that as well, where it's basically also that education should be available for all.
Right.
Okay. Then there are all kinds of other policy documents.
Yes.
Then we've got South African law. So we've got the South African Children's Act. We've got the South African Schools Act. We've got the National Development Plan. So there's all kinds of, there is legislation.
Right.
And the legislation is basically saying every child must be educated.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
And the only way that every child can be educated in South Africa is by putting every child into every school. We do not have enough special schools, and there's no plan to build so-called special schools.
Right. I understand. I mean, in this discussion, as you're saying, every child deserves an education, and they all lump together, but actually their needs are not being met. Mm. So that brings me to like a word that everybody, or that I keep coming up when I was reading articles, etc. It's what's reasonable.
Mm.
What is reasonable in practice, and who decides what's reasonable?
So the white paper says that schools must accommodate all learners wherever it is reasonably possible. Now, that reasonably is an adjective that is so wide that it can be interpreted any way you want. And in fact, if we look at the private school system in South Africa at the moment, why do we have all of these remedial schools? It's because the schools are not accommodating the learners with special needs. So these private schools have burgeoned.
Mm.
And if not a sort of a private remedial school, then we've got lots of home schools.
Mm.
And why is this happening? It's because the regular schools are just not able to accommodate the learners with special educational needs.
But it also takes such a small population, a tiny population, that can afford a special needs school.
A special needs, certainly in the private
sector. And remedial school, yeah.
Now, we've got a couple in government as well, but those children are just not being accommodated. So government has put together this concept of how things should work.
Mm.
Okay, so all kids should go to all schools. The special schools that existed in the past would then act as schools who would help the regular schools to put things in place. So there were all kinds of plans and ideas about managing things at a district level, and then every single school would be provided with funding for and staff to have a sort of educational support department. Okay, every school would have one. And they would be assisted by those from district who were more specialist level, but every school would have a support department. And that support department would be expected to assess every child on an individual basis, come up with an individual education plan, and for those who couldn't cope with a typical school curriculum, that support group would be responsible for assisting the teachers to modify the curriculum, make different worksheets, tell them how to assist the kids, etc. Now, theoretically, this is absolutely wonderful.
Right.
What are the problems? Why do schools consider this to be unreasonable for them to accommodate the learners? Okay. Mm. So let's look at what are the schools trying to do anyway, okay, for typical learners? A typical school for typical learners. In the government sector, our schools want to get kids through the school system. Okay, we want to get the best education possible, but we've got ordinary teachers with ordinary qualifications teaching lots of children in a classroom, generally with few resources, and very little support. Their goal is to get the kids through the school system, and obviously for the top learners to do as well as possible. But that's what their goal is. And they've got 40 kids in a class. Then we have the private sector. What's their goal?
Mm.
A typical private sector school. Their goal is competition. They've got to have as many distinctions as possible to get as many kids through the system with a university pass as possible, to get as many sportsmen as possible.
Okay.
Their goal is, first of all, they run as businesses, but they might not be for-profit businesses, but they've got to have beautiful sports grounds, they've got to have great classrooms, they've got to have great computer systems, etc. So they have to advertise themselves because they all need numbers.
Mm.
Okay. Schools are really, really expensive businesses. Government schools, private schools, whatever schools, it's an expensive business to run. So you've got to raise the goals and attract people to your school.
Right.
So you're now asking these schools to reasonably accept children with special learning needs when their goal is distinctions, university passes, and getting the numbers.
And sport,
just general competition.
Yes.
And the government schools, who often have the same goals, but the general government school, given the resources, they've got to get these kids through. They've got to deal with huge numbers. They've also got to deal with children who come very often from very demanding backgrounds where there might not be enough food, there might not be transport, there might not be food. Okay, so government schools have to deal with many, many other issues. And now we're putting a burden on them.
Mm.
And there is a cost.
Mm.
What is reasonable?
Nothing seems reasonable. Nothing actually seems reasonable, both in the government as well as in the private schools. Mm. In a moment, we will move from policy to reality. Children with cerebral palsy, physical difficulties, and whether inclusion should stop when they enter that gate of the school, when they're accepted into a school. We'd love to hear from you. Have you ever had to advocate for your child? WhatsApp us on 061-895-1019.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Welcome back. You're listening to Out the Box on Chai FM 101.9. I'm Simone Herring, and if you've just joined us, my guest is Dr. Karen Levine, speech pathologist, doctor of psychology, and a leading voice on inclusion. We're talking about what true inclusion looks like, or perhaps what it could look like in South African schools, and what's reasonable for parents to expect. Karen, now we're going to inclusion beyond the classroom. When people hear inclusive education, they often think only about dyslexia, ADHD, or autism. But inclusion is so much broader than all of that. And there are so many other disabilities where children are discriminated against and aren't included. Can you expand on those kinds of disabilities?
Okay, so the first thing I'm going to say is you called me a speech pathologist. I never call myself a pathologist, and there's a reason for that. Speech pathology is a term that some people in the world decided had to replace speech therapy because they thought speech therapy didn't sound either clever enough or scientific enough. But pathologist means that people are pathologized. Okay, so we look at disabled people as if they have a pathology.
Oh, wow.
So I only call myself, speech therapist. Okay. So as you mentioned, I did a PhD, luckily, with a fantastic professor of critical disability studies at Stellenbosch University, and got to understand the meaning of disability. Mm. So what do we mean by disability? Okay, because it doesn't matter if you have cerebral palsy or if you have a hearing loss, or if you walk with a walking stick. Disability is disability, okay? A disability basically means that you have some impairment, there's something in your body or in your mind that is different, that society cannot accommodate easily. That is what disability is. So some people have a hearing loss, but it's not a disability, because if they go to a school for hearing impaired people, or if they go to, for example, Gallaudet University in America, which is a university for deaf people and they're taught in sign language, they're not disabled. If you have somebody in a wheelchair and that person is provided with everything that they need, ramps, somebody to push the wheelchair,
yes,
that person in certain contexts is not disabled. Okay, so your impairment does not mean that you're going to be disabled.
Right, you can actually able these children.
And anybody. Because disability, as this wonderful scholar says, Rosemary Garland Thompson, she says disability is everywhere if you look for it.
Absolutely.
Okay, your older person who's got some memory difficulties or now needs to use a walking stick, or somebody who's got a sore hip and says, Chai FM's on the second floor of this building, okay, and I've got to go up two flights of stairs. That person is disabled.
Yes, I spoke to Marissa Moritz, and you actually sent in a voice note for us. I mean, Isaac, who is an incomplete quadriplegic, he couldn't come into the studio.
Yes, okay. And I can tell you a very amusing story about the Department of Psychology at Stellenbosch University didn't have a lift. And my professor of critical disability studies, his office was on the second floor, so they put in a lift. And unfortunately, there was some electric problem in putting in the lift and the building burned down.
Oh, my word.
Okay. But, I mean, that's just an amusing story, but actually access is not an amusing story.
No.
Okay, because also you often hear disabled people saying they're treated like second-class citizens. Mm. The ramp is at the back of the building. You know, if you want to get into a great hall of a university, you have to go around the back where there's a ramp that's been built that's actually quite narrow. And at one of our international airports, they built these marvelous toilet facilities for wheelchair access, but the front door of the bathroom facility was too small, so all the toilets were marvelous, but they actually couldn't get into the bathroom. So, these are issues that society has to deal with.
One actually has to consult with a disabled person. You actually have to bring a disabled person in and say, does this work?
Okay, so that's why in South Africa we have incredible disability activists. We have the most unbelievable disability associations. And it's really, really important that disabled people are included in all decision-making.
Mm.
Okay, in the deaf world, they used to say nothing about us. It wasn't only in the deaf world. Nothing about us without us. In others, include us in everything. Mm. Have discussions. And this is where inclusion is failing. Inclusion is failing because disabled people have not been included in the decision-making processes.
And there's also that point of which becomes one of the biggest misconceptions that we see is that if a child has cerebral palsy and perhaps struggles to speak, people automatically assume that he's intellectually or cognitively, you know, not capable of learning. So that's a very damaging assumption.
Absolutely.
How do you, I mean, there was a WhatsApp that I actually like to read to you, and you can speak to that. It's, "Hi Simon, my daughter has a cochlear implant and we're trying to find the right school. I honestly don't know what support I can ask for. Please ask your guest for suggestions."
Okay, so that comes down to what is reasonable. Okay, for a parent, any parent wants to go to the school and say, "You have to give my child every single thing that my child needs in order to do well." For the parent, everything is reasonable. For the school, well, that's a difficult one.
Yeah, and it actually was fascinating because I read that sign language has become one of the official languages in South Africa. I think that was the Bella Act in 2024. And for deaf and hard of hearing learners, that was a major shift towards success in a mainstream school, but it didn't happen. And I have a relation who did not do Afrikaans for matric and is not actually going to be accepted into teaching because she didn't do Afrikaans. So here the IEB, for instance, are saying you can get the Afrikaans, you know, the Afrikaans concession, but now are discriminating against her because she doesn't have Afrikaans and she now cannot become a teacher. And I tell you, she would be a fabulous teacher. So why not teach sign language? That would be a crucial thing to have.
Yes. But
asset to have.
So you've made 2 points here. Okay, the one is, why do we have to have Afrikaans? Why can't it be sign language? Okay. But the other, and the most important point, given what we are talking about, is this discrimination. So some schools will have policies as to who can become the head boy. The head boy must be somebody who possibly, you know, is really good at sport, or who has studied a particular language in a school, or who has whatever. And if they can't because of a learning problem or a hearing problem or a physical problem, then they're discriminated against.
Okay? Precisely.
And that's not okay. And that is exactly what the white paper was all about so long ago. And it's what the country's about. And it's what our laws are about. It's what our constitution is about. That you cannot discriminate against people on the basis of some form of disability. And you can't stop them from getting into the highest position because of some form of disability. You can't say that somebody can't become the president of South Africa because he or she's in a wheelchair and cannot get into the Houses of Parliament through the front door. Okay, this is discrimination. Okay, but the question is, why are our schools actually failing? Why is inclusion not happening? Okay, so there's been some research, Simon. There's been some really hot research. For example, the Human Sciences Research Council has come up with really good studies. There's been a big study at Stellenbosch University. And essentially, it comes down to this. We've got wonderful policies. I mean, they're world-class policies, but we have problems with implementation. It's all very well talking about it, but we don't have implementation. Most importantly, we don't have implementation plans. Secondly, we don't have funding. This government is not providing adequate funding for the implementation of all of these wonderful ideas. And thirdly, there's no accountability. So although everybody said, you know, in this white paper, wonderful, you've got X amount of time in which to put these things in place, there's just no accountability. And that's terribly sad.
That takes me to another question, is when a school advertises or you go into a meeting and they say, we can help your child who's dyslexic, who has severe ADHD, who may be deaf, and they say, no, we've got Ed support. And Ed Support will be able to help your child and support them and scaffold them. I don't understand what Ed Support in schools is.
As I said, the white paper said that every school must have an Ed Support structure. Okay. But now look at who is in that Ed Support department. Essentially, as my understanding, is many of them are, well, everybody has to be a teacher, a qualified teacher, with some kind of training in special education.
Right.
We have the so-called remedial teachers, and then we have teachers who've done maybe a month's course on special ed, and that is, those are the fundamental members of the support team, and then very often there's an educational psychologist, a speech therapist, OT, a clinical psychologist. It depends on the structure. The question we have to ask ourselves is, how well trained are those individuals in inclusion? We have remedial teachers who can do fantastic remedial work, but do they know how to go into the classroom and support those kids? How do we modify the curriculum? So in policy, it's wonderful, but in reality, it doesn't always work. And the demand is enormous.
Do you think that it works in America?
It's hard to say in America. It's a very big place, and we have, you know, millions of schools. And does it work in Europe? And does it work in Denmark? And does it work in...
Has it worked anywhere?
Yes, yes. In many cases, it has worked. But you have to have a whole lot of things in place. Where does inclusion work? Let's look at what do we know about the barriers. And then we'll know if we can overcome those barriers, then the inclusion will work. So what are the barriers? First of all, our teachers have to be trained. You cannot expect a teacher who's been to teachers training college or university, who has been taught how to teach the regular class of kids, you can't expect them to accommodate children with special education needs when they don't know how to identify those problems and what to do. And you're asking them to modify the curriculum and they haven't got a clue what you're talking about. Okay, so our teachers need training, and they need ongoing training and proper training. Okay,
so it's not just a course that you've taken for CPD points here and there.
Absolutely not. And when you're asking a speech therapist to go in and assist that speech therapist, hopefully at an educational level at university, has also learned how to do this. And our universities including this in the curriculum for teachers. I'm not sure that it's happening all over the world.
And what about this, I don't know what it's called, but it's this way of becoming a teacher where you do a BA or something and then you do a year of teaching. Now, I was at WITS and I did a four-year course and I came out, and when I did my award in literacy and dyslexia, I realized I had no idea how to teach reading. Honestly,
okay, that's scary.
I looked back and I thought, every child should be learning how to read the way we teach a dyslexic student in a multi-sensory, systematic way. So now we're taking people, they do this 1 year, and then they go into the classrooms.
And, you know, in some of our high schools, people are not qualified teachers. Some of our high schools are employing engineers.
Yes.
So that's a big thing for me, is the training of the teachers. When I say a big thing for me, it's, and I haven't sucked it out of my thumb, this comes out of an HSRC study.
Well, there's no pedagogy.
The second is the lack of professional and non-professional support. What do we mean by non-professional support? The person who needs assistance going to the bathroom. The child who has a meltdown, a child possibly with sensory issues who needs to be taken out of the classroom every now and again but cannot go independently, and they need a so-called non-professional person to assist them. And then so it's the lack, and this is what the HSRC identified, that it's lack of professional and non-professional support is a serious problem in government. This is all in government schools. Right. This isn't research in private schools. Then, and very, very significantly, is a lack of parent involvement. And we see this time and time again. I see it as a speech therapist, where parents will sometimes bring the child to me for therapy, and I will send stuff home to be done in between the sessions, and it's not done. Mm. And the attitude is, I'm paying you. I want you to fix the child. I haven't got time. And a lot of the time, when we say there's a lack of parent involvement, it's not that parents don't want to be involved. Okay, a lot of the time, parents are stressed. They have other children. They have to go to work. They might be hungry. They might have an old parent who needs to be cared for as well. They might have more than one child with special educational needs.
I was just about to say that. The
parents are under unbelievable pressure, so it's very, very hard for them to provide the kind of support within the school to come to the meetings. Sometimes they don't have transport. A lot of the time meetings are at night.
And what was interesting when you say that, yesterday I was assessing a little boy who is 10 years old. He's in grade 3. He's now failed grade 3 for the second time. He's from rural Limpopo, cannot speak English, cannot read in his own language. And his mom said to me, he's scared of white people. And I think that that's so relevant, because I think the parents as well as the children feel intimidated when they go and sit in front of somebody who is educated. I'm not even saying white, I'm saying educated. And that keeps parents away.
Educated and in a position of power. All of us are scared of going into the principal's office. Okay. And we don't want to upset teachers. We don't want to. There's all kinds
fine
of
line.
Issues around.
It's a fine line.
But certainly parent involvement is a key feature where parents are really the only ones who can advocate for their children. So to that mum of the child with a cochlear implant, my words are, you go in and demand whatever you want to demand. You can be as nice about it as possible. Don't be scared of upsetting people. But go and be the advocate for your child.
After the break, we'll get very practical. We'll speak about dyslexia, ADHD, autism, and other barriers, and how to advocate for your child, as Karen was just saying.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
I'm Simone, and I'm talking with Karen Levine, unpacking what meaningful inclusion really looks like in South African schools. We've covered policy, we've covered some of physical and speech and hearing disabilities and the importance of belonging, and now we're going to address other learning barriers and disorders. So Karen, we're going to move into practical support and advocacy. And I received a WhatsApp, which I was really excited to get, because it was from Dr. Tully Frankel, who was one of your students. And she is a regular on the show, and she's fabulous. So to get a question from her, I thought was just really wonderful. And thank you, Tully. The question goes like this. In some inclusion models, like the one in which I work, there's a pull-out system for kids who need additional academic support. So the children leave the classroom and go to a support room where they're given additional language and maths assistance. However, this means that they're missing out on critical classroom time. That isn't always easy to catch up. Sometimes it feels like there's an infinite loop of scrambling to just keep up. What's your best suggestion for how to implement support with challenging mainstream, especially dual curriculum environments?
That's such a hard question, because every child with special learning needs who's included sometimes gets pulled out. They have to go for speech, they have to go for OT, and then they're going for extra reading. And a lot of the time, it's not just that they're missing academic support, they're also missing out on fun. So often when it's time for sports, that's when the kids are so-called permitted to go for academic support. So they miss out on the one thing that they're really good at and the one thing that really helps them to socialize.
And that's one of my big problems is that when I'm told that my child needs to go to a clinic, which is after school, and the reason why he is at school is because of sport, he refuses to go. And And rightly so, Karen, because sport keeps him coming back to school.
What is inclusion? It's not, so we don't only go to school to be educated. Mm. We go to school to learn to socialize and to make and maintain relationships and to problem solve. And we learn our language and communication strategies by communicating with others. And we learn how to be a good sportsman and learn all kinds of stuff. It's not just about learning to read and write. So exclusion happens on the sports field as well.
Yes. And also for physically disabled children, can we not find a space for them on the sports field? You know, is there like a, I'm not sure, a person who would manage the team or something? Can we not include them?
Well, what does this come down to? It comes down to teachers and sports coaches and everybody involved in the school getting better training. First of all, understanding disability and understanding what it means to be excluded. And I think that this is where we are. For me, what's underpinning the lack of teacher training, the lack of parent involvement, the lack of professional support, and the inadequate allocation of resources, what's underpinning it all is a lack of understanding of the meaning of disability. And I think that's where we need to start. We need to start in our schools. We need to start in our institutions. We need to look at it as at ourselves as a society. What do we understand about what it means to be disabled? And disabled means to be excluded. Mm. I'm excluded from the sports ground. I'm excluded from social stuff because I've got, I don't look like I should look. I'm excluded because I'm in a wheelchair, so I can't go to the second floor of Hive M. Mm. I am excluded because I have a hearing loss, and the place that I'm going is so noisy that I can't possibly use my hearing aids. Yeah. What does it mean to be excluded? What is disability? And how do we need to look at disability as a society? Are we addressing the moral rights of everybody? So what do I mean by this? In many philosophical discussions at very high levels, the likes of, there's a very well-known Professor Singer, and he says that disabled people do not necessarily have the same moral rights as people who are not disabled because they can't contribute to society and they might drain society and be bad for others. Okay. Then we have parents of seriously disabled individuals who've got together, the likes of which is Eva Feder Kitte in New York, and who have disabled children. And for them, that kind of talk is abominable. It's just absolutely unacceptable. And in South Africa, part of our white paper and part of our constitution, which comes from our apartheid past, is to remediate human thinking and to understand that everybody is of equal moral standing. And if you consider the child with dyslexia or the child with a hearing loss or the child in a wheelchair to have the same moral status as the typical learner, then everything changes. Then everything becomes, they are of equal moral status, so therefore we must provide for them what they need.
And everybody wants to contribute to society. You cannot tell me that a person who is able to contribute to society doesn't want to. And that's what makes them feel like they belong. But just going back to that pull-out system, aside from missing out on things, is it a successful system?
No. And that's, in fact, it's one of the things in the white paper. It said the pull-out system should not be. Children must be accommodated in the classroom. But that's really, you know, that's theoretical. And sometimes kids really need individualized help.
So this comes to another question that I have, is that this is a different reality in high school. Some learners are so profoundly dyslexic, because very often they have such significant ADHD or autism or other disorders that go along with their learning barriers that parents ask whether the school would allow the child to receive private specialist tuition and the parents pay that cost during the school day, even if it means missing that class. So, for instance, if a child needed more help in maths, during the maths lessons, can an individual teacher who is a specialist and obviously vetted by the school, can they come in and teach the child? Because this is offering, this is very often a failing child, and one-on-one learning would be prize one. Why would there be an obstacle?
Theoretically, there should not be an obstacle, because the school should do everything that they can that is reasonable to accommodate the child.
We're going to come back to that. We're just going to have an ad break.
Out the Box is brought to you by the South African Jewish Museum. Preserving our past, celebrating the present, and inspiring our future.
Thank you for tuning in to Out the Box on Chai FM 101.9. We always love to hear from our listeners, so if you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, send them to 061-895-1019. And remember that if you've missed part of this conversation, then you can always catch up on the Chai FM website. There's the list of podcasts, and you can listen in your own time. Karen, going back to that situation where a child is failing, you want to bring in a private specialist teacher, which you do, and perhaps for some reason there's little collaboration or little support for that teacher. How does a parent deal with that, and what is reasonable?
Okay, so I think that given what the HSRC came up with, saying that the lack of parent involvement is one of the major factors, one of the major barriers to inclusion, my advice, and certainly as we come to the end of this program, my advice to parents is this: you are the only ones who can truly advocate for your children. And to date, I have not seen sufficient activism on the part of parents. I have not seen parents being given the acknowledgement of being the best advocates for their children by the school systems. And I haven't seen parents demand enough.
So that's very interesting, because when I was researching what inclusion is, there was a section on how to advocate, and it was very, very profound. What they said is that parents need to group together.
Yes.
And they need to advocate for their children together. Mm-hmm. They're saying that numbers are more effective. Why aren't parents advocating? Why aren't we getting together?
Because nobody's done it. So, you know, most schools have got a parent-teachers association.
Mm.
Okay. Why don't schools have the Association of Parents of Children with Special Learning Needs who are accommodated in those schools? Just go and get it together. Somebody, you know, it takes one individual to get it started. And I'm talking about private schools. I'm talking about government schools. You know, even at the nursery school level, get together as parents, and group advocacy would work. And also start looking at disability support that already exists. There's a lot of stuff out there. There's a lot of activism in South Africa. There are disability action groups. And it's, you know, just go and Google them and you'll find them and get involved. And you'd be surprised at the amount of help. There's also an entire academic school of thought, which is called this critical disability studies. At most of the universities, there are departments that look at disability, why society doesn't accommodate, what's happening, exclusion in society generally, marginalization in the workplace. You know, we've got a policy though of we have to include disabled people in the workplace. But if we're not including them at a school level, how are we going to include them in the workplace? Mm. So go and look. I'm saying to the, you know, parents of disabled children, and don't be frightened of the word disabled. If your child is not coping at school, your child is disabled. Okay, it's not a scary word. Disabled doesn't necessarily mean a severe disability. Okay, disability is everywhere if you look for it. Right. And don't be scared of labeling your child disabled. Okay. I can talk quite openly about I have a very, very tall son. Very tall. He cannot go on an aeroplane unless he's got extra leg room, because otherwise he sits with his knees up on his ears, and it's just not fair.
And okay? That's a disability.
In that context, his height is a disability.
Right.
Okay, and I'm not scared of using the word disability in that context. Most children are not disabled in their home if they've got loving parents. Okay, but if they don't, then they are. So go and become activists. And find out how, and group together, and demand of the schools, demand of the teachers.
So let me put this out there to all of you who are struggling with a child who has a form of disability. WhatsApp me on 061-895-1019, and perhaps, just perhaps, we can get it together. Karen, I just want to circle back to taking a child out, giving them lessons, particularly at the high school level where a child is failing a subject. Does it not seem obvious to you? Because it seems obvious to me.
Okay, so Simon, I think what's really important is that we also have to respect the situation of the school. Here we are, I'm saying parents, go and demand. And I'm saying you also have to look at what the school can reasonably give you. And communication is really the core of everything. Mm. And you might think that something's in the best interests of your child, and you might think that the school should just do it. But maybe they have their reasons. And I think that communication is really, really important. And if you feel that you can't do it alone, take somebody with you.
Yes, I always
because sometimes
recommend.
Parents don't hear what the school is saying.
And just to keep that temperature low and feelings, intact.
And expectations. We all have expectations of our spouses, and they don't do what we think that they should be doing. And then they say, "Why didn't you tell me?" And it's the same thing when we're communicating with teachers and schools. Sometimes our expectations and their expectations are not matched.
I understand. Karen, I really wanted to get into what's equal and what's fair, but unfortunately our time has come up and we need to close today. So if there was one very quick word of advice that you would like to give to a head of a school or a teacher or a parent, can you... Very quickly, because Craig's showing me the watch.
Stand up for your child.
Mm.
Schools, stand up for the kids. We all need a space.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. I'm going to leave you with this quote by George Day. Inclusion is not bringing people into what already exists. It is making a new space, a better space for everyone. Enjoy What the World Needs Now by Dionne Warwick.